Did you guys get your honey boxes from Ryan today? Your little goodie box? Mississippi.
Yeah, I got mine.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Aaron, did you get yours?
No, I think Santa Claus is coming tomorrow for me.
Okay, cool. And I know Jeff got his because he cheated already.
Somehow or another, that corridor between Minneapolis and Kansas City is really freaking fast. I noticed that.
Mine came today, and I got to tell you, though, it's apparent that Ryan taped up the box. I know Andrea had nothing to do with packaging the box and taping up the box. That was definitely a male person who taped up my box. I don't know who taped up your box, but it took me about 10 minutes to finally get in the damn thing.
I didn't taste anything yet, but I did take a whiff of the honeys, and I can tell you now, there's Metafoam in my future. No doubt about it. Metafoam.
Ooh.
I'm looking. So, when it comes around, Ryan off here for a week or so. I did talk to him down in Florida here, a couple days ago. And he had just landed, already complaining about the humidity being like 300%. And I said, well, wait till you get over to Phoenix. And I said, the humidity is going to be like negative 300%. So you'll go the other direction. It's going to be hotter than hell, but it'll be certainly a whole lot drier than Florida. But hey, welcome to the Mead House today. Everybody knows where to go to get it, themeadhouse.com. And, of course, the Facebook thing, we keep harping on that. Love the way business is picking up over there. Just type in the Mead House if you haven't been to it, up there in that little search deal. And I'm sure you'll find it. Like I said, Ryan Richardson, he's off tonight. He's gallivanting around town. Aaron Martin is with us. Mississippi Chris Spencer out of Mississippi. Yeah, that's right. Jeff Schaus, and my name is J.D. Webb. So I thought we'd get the ball rolling here. Jeff usually cruises around the Facebook and finds some interesting people and some interesting posts for us to talk about here at the beginning of the show. So, Jeff, what'd you find this week, bud?
So I've got one shout out tonight and then a couple questions that were posed, and I thought I would throw them out to the group and kind of get some input and see if you guys have seen this before. The shout out's going to Adam Thompson. He posted a few days ago a couple pictures with these stainless steel clarifying filters that I forget exactly where it is, whether it's More Beer or Midwest Supply, but one of the two of them has these guys. They fit in a standard filter housing, and they're totally reusable. You just basically rinse them out after use. They come in 5 micron, 2 micron, and 1 micron, and he's using a 5 and a 2, along with a little diaphragm pump to keep mead circulating through them. He shared a little bit of tips as far as his own experience and getting them to work right, things he'd learned playing with them there. But man, I've been thinking about those guys for quite a while, just because the reusable aspect of that, it makes it really attractive to me. So excited to see some like usage out of those, and hope to see more. I'm really, really strongly thinking about getting a set of those for myself.
You're talking filters that go in one of those whole house filter deals, canisters?
Right. I believe they're about 10 inches long. You get all kinds of them. I know you've talked about using one with your vacuum setup kind of be an overflow catcher. Same kind of a thing. They just fit right into one of those, and you can push them through with CO2 between two kegs. You can use a pump like Adam was doing. They're pretty versatile once you got the filter kind of set up in one of those canisters there.
Oh, interesting. So, cool.
Yeah, no, I'm interested in that for sure. One of my first questions here was from Chris Schnulluk. I hope I'm not butchering your name, Chris. He asked essentially about using pectin. And I guess the thrust of his question is, can you use pectin to help clarify a mead after it's done fermenting? That struck me as a really interesting question, because I actually happen to have a plum and a nectarine mead that have been sitting for probably 2 or 3 months and show like no inclination to clear whatsoever. So I thought I'd open the floor to that and see if you guys have ever used any pectin after the fact, you guys have had any results with that.
Isn't that kind of the, well, I'm going to shoot this over to Chris, but first, isn't that kind of the reverse of what we talked about last week, Chris?
Right. I think it is. Especially with, not necessarily with the pectin itself, but with the lalozyme. You know, Chris was talking about using that for maximum juice and flavor extraction from your fruit. So the clarity is a kind of a different issue, but yeah, it's the same idea, I think, but in reverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting question, because the way that I understand it, the pectic enzyme doesn't exert its activity quite as well in the presence of alcohol, which is the reason you want to try and use it before fermentation starts. You want to give it, some people say at least 12 hours to work before you pitch your yeast. I've never used it after fermentation. I think there's much better alternatives after fermentation is over. Probably your easiest way, if you have temperature control, is just cold crashing. And that's a subject that we need to cover a little bit more, either on this show or a future show, is the benefits of cold conditioning after fermentation is over. That's probably the easiest, but then you've got bentonite, you've got all sorts of two-part fining agents, you've got hot mix sparkaloid, and I think all of those are much better options post-fermentation.
I wonder if he's, I mean, because there are different kinds of pectin out there. There's the instant kind, or the powdered kind that Ball has. There's liquid kind. There is the gel kind.
I think you're confusing pectin with pectic enzyme.
No. There are different kinds of pectins out there that you can use. I've used a number of them in my jelly making.
That's adding pectin to it. The pectic enzyme breaks that down.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think if he didn't mean some other type of product like Nox gelatin, which is didn't Ryan say something about using Nox as a clarifier? I'm wondering if he's talking about something like that, and not necessarily pectin, unless he named it by, you know, had a product name or something. I don't know. Be worth looking into, though. But no, I agree. The whole pectin, the whole idea is to knock the pectin out. I mean, pectin is like not the thing you want in your mead.
The Nox gelatin is an acceptable fining agent, but it will bring some tannin with it. So you have to be careful if it's an advantage if you need to lower your tannin level, but if you already have it where you want it, then that's probably not what you want to be using.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. What else, Jeff?
Okay. So the last one, I'm going to read this one word for word because it's a bit of a story here. This is from Glenn Salt, and he posted this today on the Mead Makers Forum. Says, I've got a question about making cider. Last fall, I made several batches, and all but one came out fine. The one that failed was, of course, the most expensive. I used unpasteurized, unfiltered apple juice. The juice was very tart. I did not use any potassium metabisulfite, but pitched the yeast and got a good fermentation fairly fast. The next day, I left on a 10-day cruise. I racked the mead from primary when we returned. Fermentation had stopped, but it needed clearing. I tasted it at the time, and it was a bit yeasty, but a good apple flavor. As it began to clear, it developed an almond flavor. The longer time I waited, the more like old bruised apples it tasted. Classic case of oxidation, I've been told. So, did the oxidation occur during the long period of primary? Should I have used potassium metabisulfite? I know Chris has played a lot with Sizers and Ciders, and I thought he might want to weigh in on this, especially.
Did he mention what he was using for primary? Was it a bucket or a carboy? Or
he does not mention that, no.
Yeah, that's kind of important. If you left it in a bucket for a long period of time, you very well could have gotten oxidation. So, you know, I'm not opposed to leaving things in primary for a while, but you really got to be careful as to what kind of seal you have. And most of these buckets, even though they have a seal in the lid, they're not ideal for long-term storage. You usually want to get them on out pretty quick. And if it was in a carboy, unless your airlock went dry or you had a really bad seal on the stopper, I would doubt it. I would doubt it's oxidation. I don't know. I do know though that with a sizer, oxidation is not always a bad thing. Sometimes just a little bit of oxidation can really enhance the flavor of a sizer, and it also can really help a cherry melomel too.
I would, you know, it depends on. You know, one thing for sure, I think it would depend on what yeast to use, but I got to go along with Chris. I mean, if he used a bucket, I could see the oxidization being, you know, having an impact. But there again, if he used a yeast that, say, takes 7, 8, 9 days, and I mean, it also depends on the temperature, the ambient temperature, or at least its fermentation temps. I mean, 10 days isn't really out of line for fermenting itself. So,
yeah.
And
go ahead.
I got a funny feeling that he may have had yeast. There again, if he didn't use a killer yeast, he may have had a yeast come alive from the apple juice if he used unfiltered, unrefined, whatever apple juice. If it was right out of an orchard, that would be my second.
And another thought, if that apple juice was severely oxidized before he started fermentation, it's going to still be oxidized afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my take. Aaron, you got anything different on it?
No, you know, JD, when you started talking about yeast and going down that path, that was where my mind was going as well. And granted, I don't have near the experiences, you know, some of the others on the line here when it comes to ciders and sizers. But one of the things that we always talk about is just the diverse qualities you can achieve with different honey varieties and the interactions that you get there with different types of yeast. And maybe this is just some combination of apple and yeast that produces a less than desirable quality in the finished product, possibly.
Yeah.
I will say this. Orchard bought cider juice is notorious for being oxidized because it's pressed. Yeah. There's no telling how long the pressing takes, how long it sits out. Then it gets poured into another container, which then gets probably poured into bottles or jugs. And usually almost all of the cider, unless they're being very careful, is going to be oxidized to some degree when you get it. That's why it's so dark. And that flavor can carry over right into your beverage that you make from it. So yeah. Maybe you did everything right. Maybe you just had oxidation in it before you started.
Yeah. Jeff, what do you think?
Well, you guys have raised some very strong points. I would say there is definitely the possibility of either a competing yeast going in there and causing some havoc. I mean, if this is an oxidation,
issue as opposed to just another off flavor. I'm not sure if that would be necessarily the strongest culprit, but I do definitely think that there is a possibility that we had some oxidization occurring beforehand. Chris raised some very valid points about the potential for apple juice just to get oxidized as it's going through the mechanical process of being made into cider. And really, the I think it probably did bear using some potassium metabisulfite, if not to kill competing yeast strands that are resident on the skin of the apples, at the very least, to give a little antioxidant protection there.
Yeah. You know, and in the cider making, I've made cider with both something like treetop pure apple juice that's not from concentrate. You can find it at old Costco, Sam's Club, that kind of thing, if you've got them around. And I've used the fresh pressed, unfiltered organic juices. One in particular that Chris and I used in that graph, Simply Apple, I think it's called, which is unfiltered natural apple juice. Not a damn bit of difference in cider making, as far as I'm concerned. So, you don't necessarily know what kind of apples you're getting, unless you go to an orchard and you specifically, tell the orchard this is what you want, or they have a listing of what apples they pressed that week or month or whatever. But I find the stuff that you get in the store, Mott's apple juice, treetop, as long as it's 100% apple juice, no preservatives, nothing else, and it'll say, and not from concentrate. I find it perfectly acceptable for making pretty good cider. So, you know what? Do me a favor.
I tend to prefer that Simply Apple because it doesn't have vitamin C added. And
yeah.
I'm real sensitive to tartness. So if I can reduce the tartness at all, that I'm going to.
Yeah, and Jeff, do me a favor, make contact with the guy. Tell him to listen to episode 49 and, let him know that we talked about it. And, maybe we can help answer his question here. Maybe he'll get some ideas. But good stuff. Sure. Anything else?
That was it for now. But I did just want to, throw a suggestion to our audience. And if you guys think of something that you want to ask, I know we've had a number of people writing in with comments or questions. We got a Facebook page, we've got a website. Feel free to reach out and, shoot us a question. And if there are other places that I should be looking for cool stuff, I've heard that Reddit has a really thriving community of homebrewers too. Give us the suggestion and we'll check it out and we'll kind of add a little bit more to the, the input of all the cool stuff we've got coming into the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Good stuff, Jeff. And let's jump into the. And I gotta tell you, I'm drinking some stuff. I'm gonna let somebody else go first. Let's go to Aaron. Aaron, what are you drinking tonight?
So my exploration of local South Carolina beers continues. This week, I am drinking. It's called Trifecta IPA. This is a beer from Thomas Creek Brewery located in Greenville, South Carolina. And I got to tell you guys, I am just like searching for a replacement IPA. Probably my favorite beer, at least in the last year or so, has been this Nebraska Brewing Company IPA, haven't been able to find that one down here. So looking for a good IPA, and this one definitely comes close to hitting the mark. It's a little bit darker for an IPA, approaching more the color, not quite to maybe a brown ale in color. So a little bit darker for IPAs as they come. Also a little bit more malt forward in the flavor profile, but a really nice balance with some kind of citrusy hops going on. All in all, a very solid beer, and maybe a contender here to take that place as kind of that staple beer that, that always finds its way in the fridge.
Cool. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Jeff, what are you doing tonight, Jeff?
Tonight I've got a nice big bottle of St. Vrain Triple Ale from Left Hand Brewing Company. And we've talked a number of times about Belgian beers on the show here. And I think I had erroneously stated one time that these beer names like double, triple, quad, they're all relative to the quantity of hops, the quantity of malt, or something along those lines. It turns out, doing more research on the topic, these are actually very distinct styles, and the triple is it's a little bit more like an IPA than anything else. But it still has some characteristics that make it really Belgian. I mean, this has a lot of a yeasty character to it that gives it some spice and some interesting flavor notes there. But at the same time, it's got a really smooth bitter finish. The hops aren't as aggressive as I'm used to with American IPAs, but they're definitely present. They mix nicely, and it has a really slight kind of malty sweetness on the mid palate too, which, you know, it makes it a really smooth, really enjoyable drink.
Interesting. Sounds good.
That does sound good. Just to chime in real quick with a experience that I had recently with a very fascinating triple. Have you guys ever heard of, I think it's Victory Brewing Company that does a triple, what do they call it? I forget what their regular triple is called, something monkey, golden monkey. I came across a sour triple from them. It's called the Sour Monkey that incorporates Brett, and just had a couple of bottles of that maybe in the last week or so as well. And it was just a really, really enjoyable beer. It kind of incorporates, like you're saying, Jeff, some of those Belgian characteristics with that tartness and sourness. Really good for this time of the year as it's warming up outside.
That does sound interesting.
Yeah.
Sounds
definitely
good.
Definitely recommend it.
There you go. I know what Chris is drinking. How about that cup of coffee?
Yeah, you know me.
Well, at least I know it ain't Starbucks. I know that.
No, it's not Starbucks, and it won't be. Yeah. I have an issue with Starbucks. I encourage everyone to boycott, please. Thank you.
And Ryan isn't here tonight, so I guess that leaves this one up to me. Now, let me tell you something. Every time I take a sip of this thing that I'm drinking, I got to unpucker my lips with a screwdriver. This stuff, I'm drinking a Samuel Smith. Now, the reason why I picked this up is I've had a Samuel Smith hard cider. Now, this is a product of England. And so it's an imported beverage, and I've had their cider, a lot like an Irish cider, like a lot like Magners. And I really like Samuel Smith, and I like Magners both. This particular one that I'm drinking, I saw the label on this, and it says, organic, handcrafted fruit ale, cherry. And I thought, so this would be like a beer with cherries in it or something. So I picked it up, I brought it on, put it on ice, and dude, this is, I mean, if you know, you can scratch the ale part off, this is like the most tart cherry juice I've ever had in my life. it's brewed with barley and wheat, so apparently they brew the ale part first and then add the cherry juice to it, but I'm having a real hard time trying to find that ale. It's all cherry. It's good. This would be terrific on a hot, well, it was 91 here today anyway, so it was, you know, good on a hot day, but oh boy, is it tart. So, that's what I'm drinking.
Can I Can I clarify my statement so people don't think I'm an asshole totally?
Sure.
Which they probably do anyway, and that's okay. I bought boxes of Starbucks K-Cups and bought them for a long time, and they're already priced higher than the others. So one day I opened a box, and I noticed that it didn't look like it was full. So I counted them, and there was 16 K-Cups. And so I read on the box, and it said 16 cups. I guess it's my fault for not reading it. But so the next time I went to the store, I started looking around, and everyone else's boxes has 18 cups in it. Everyone, every brand, 18 cups. Same box, same size box. They're shorting you 2 cups. That really ticked me off. All this time, I've been shorted 2 cups in each box. And so I boycotted.
So you boycotted. Okay.
I want my other two. There's room in there for 2 more cups. Everyone else puts 18 cups in a box. I want my 18 cups.
Okay. And now we know
that's
why.
That's clarified.
Yep. And Jeff, you want to go ahead and put Chris's soapbox away? And
I'm done. No, I'm finished.
I can respect your anger, Chris. I've been boycotting Starbucks for quite a while just because I'm not very fond of the way they over-roast those beans.
Yeah. I don't drink Starbucks at all because I think they're just simply overpriced. But, hey, that's just me. But so anyway. I won't even use it in my mead. So, but let's not go down that road either, because that particular trail needs a lot of work. I sent out an email to everybody, and I said the other day, and I made a huge mistake, but I'll explain. I sent out this email to the crew, and I said, you know, wife and I made a day trip, went out to the desert, out to Hadley's. I was thoroughly disappointed. Not the place that I remember. Of course, they moved into a whole new building, more like a mini mart now, but that's my rant for a later date. The intention was to come home with bags and bags and bags of some dried, dehydrated fruits. And, you know, I'm looking for apricots, peaches, cherries, pineapple. And they're well known out in this part of the country. Been there for 100 years. So I was really looking forward to it. Wound up coming home with 4 bags of freeze-dried, not dehydrated, guys. And I apologize for the email that I sent out because I think I stated dehydrated. And Chris is writing back about 4 pounds of cherries equaling 4 ounces of dehydrated and blah 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 blah, and it didn't dawn on me. So we're talking freeze dried. Big difference here. So Chris, you're gonna have to start all over, my friend. I have 8 ounces of freeze dried cherries, which are like little cherry bombs. Along with the raspberries that I got, two bags of raspberries. So
I still think that's too much for a gallon for what you're trying to accomplish.
Well, it may be, because I busted open the bag and I popped one of them little cherry bombs into my mouth. And, I think you're right. they are like whacked out tart. And, I mean, they're 100% freeze dried. There's nothing added, no preservatives, no nothing except for. Now, the only thing that bothers me is the bag apparently was filled with Chris, SO2, carbon or not carbon, carbon monoxide,
sulfur
right?
dioxide. Oh,
sulfur dioxide. I guess for you know, if that's supposed to be some kind of preservative or whatever. But anyway. So, which is okay, because I'll just, you know, pop a Camden tablet and let it set for 24 hours if that's the case. And but the, you know, we had talked, I think, yeah, a couple shows ago, about using freeze-dried or dehydrated fruits as your base for, you know, something fruity, cherry mead or whatever. And so I have this experiment that I'm going to start maybe tonight, maybe tomorrow night. I've got some leftover, I've got 3 pounds of clover honey left over, and was just going to drop maybe a pound and a half or so. I didn't want this thing sweet. So, you know, 2 8-ounce bags of freeze-dried cherries. I mean, how many ounces do you think I had to drop into the thing? 2 ounces?
I would put 2 ounces at the most.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just looking for a hint of cherry flavor, because I don't want it to come out, you know, that sweet cough syrupy type stuff that you typically get with cherries. I have no idea what kind of cherries these are. I have no clue whatsoever. Hell, they might even be Bing cherries, as far as I know.
you don't even know if they're tart or sweet or.
They're tart. Well, it says tart cherries on the package, and they are tart. They are definitely.
Okay. Well, you're probably okay as far as the cough syrup goes, but if you're going to take this thing dry, you're going to have a problem if you get too much tartness in it. So,
yeah.
It's going to be easy to do with tart cherries.
Yeah, and that's what I and a little bit of tartness would be fine in this thing, but, you know, like you say, this thing's going to be dry, so I've really got to be careful. And I just want a hint of cherry. I want it in the back of your mind after you finish your swallow that, there must have been cherries in this. I'm not looking for a cherry mead per se.
Honestly, JD, I'd start with 1/2 ounce. You can always add more as you're aging it, but, you know, if 2 ounces is just way too much, and those, you know, bear in mind the difference between a dehydrated cherry and a freeze-dried cherry may only be about 10-15% water, but that's a lot of mass overall that you're no longer having to compensate for when you're figuring out weights and stuff. So these things might be little flavor bombs all by themselves. I would say play it safe. Go 1/2 ounce for a start, and then let it dial in. If you need more cherry flavor to really make it apparent, you know, add another 1/2 ounce. Wait a few days and see what happens.
Yeah, that's an idea. I think I'll go with that plan. But this is a, you know, we've always talked about using whole fruits and organic fruits and whatnot. You know, we've kind of touched upon, you know, well, you know, what about using dehydrated fruit? You know, if you can't get the real deal that's, you know, ripe enough to make a melomel out of, why not use some dehydrated stuff and see if you can accomplish the same thing? So this is my experiment. And we'll try it that way. Jeff, you got a good plan there.
You know, one question on that subject that I'd be interested to hear your guys' thoughts on. Using dehydrated fruit, and I think I may know the answer to this, but would that impact your use of pectic enzyme at all?
Got to be very careful, because most dehydrated fruit is, especially things like raisins, cherries, not so much apricots or peaches or pineapple, but typically raisins. And cherries, they're rolled in sunflower oil, very light sunflower oil. I mean, it's hard to even tell there's any on there. If you put them between your fingertips and kind of rub them a little bit, you'll get kind of a waxy substance on your finger, and that's sunflower oil. That you have to be careful with. And that's why I went out to Hadley's, because they used to have just pure, unadulterated, untouched, dried fruit, you know, no preservative, no sunflower oil, no nothing. And that was my whole purpose. So that you got to be real careful with. But yeah, I don't see any reason why you can't use pectic enzyme or anything on dehydrated stuff.
My take on it is if it has fruit juice or anything to do with fruit, it's getting a dose of pectic enzyme.
Makes sense.
Yeah, that's a better safe than sorry. I think the trick here is going to be dialing in exactly how much pectic enzyme you need once you've, a lot of the suggested use of pectic enzyme is based on using fresh fruit that has all of the water content attached to it. The water content being gone, it really skews the ratios as far as the weight of the fruit, the content of the pectic enzyme, pectin in the fruit, and how much enzyme you need to neutralize all of that. So you might be playing a little bit of a guessing game there, but I would still say, yeah, I would definitely use some pectic, even if I'm taking a shot in the dark as to how much I need.
Yeah, because the pectin in things like cherries and plums and those kind of things, the pectin is actually in the skin itself, not necessarily in the fruit. It's in the skin, and so I would definitely use pectic enzyme. You know, of course, I don't know that those other two that we talked about last week would even have any benefit. Because I think the three, we're talking three different kinds of additives here. We're talking pectic enzyme, but then we're talking lalazyme, EX, and CMAX, right?
Yeah. I don't know if I would go so far as to use those with dehydrated fruit or freeze-dried fruit, but it's in a way, it's kind of two different things here, because with the lalazyme, I'm aiming to get as much out of the fruit as I can. But with pectic enzyme, I'm thinking more about post-fermentation clearing. So when I think just using pectic enzyme, I'm thinking more about how this thing's going to clear down the road. And I've had a few melomels that came out that I used pectic enzyme on and they didn't clear. And then when I started thinking about it and trying to figure out why they weren't clearing, I realized that this fruit was high in amylase or in amylopectins. And so that's sort of when I started using amylase as a, if I use pectic enzyme, I use amylase with it.
Yeah.
Because you just never know. I mean, you can, if you want to take the time, you can look it up and find a list of fruit or make your own list of fruit that's high in amylase, amylopectin. I throw the enzymes to it because I haven't discovered any ill effects from use or overuse. And if you can possibly get benefit with no downsides, why not just use it and be done with it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's, my jelly and jam making has given me, a little bit of experience with this whole pectin thing. There are some, like cherries, plums, off the top of my head, cranberries is another one, that you don't need to add any other kind of pectin. Apples, the same thing. You don't need to add any other kind of pectin into it, other than, just your sugar and your fruit, and that's it. Because there's plenty of pectin in the fruit that will make it set up and gel. Without the additional pectin that you would dump in during your boil. So, there's a number of other fruits out there that do the same thing. So that experience has told me what fruits really need, you really need to pay attention to as far as pectin, pectic enzyme, and then other fruits that are not so bad. But at any rate, I think I know what direction I'm going to go with this little project, with this little experiment. And always appreciate you guys' help on this. I did send out the copy of my recipe, Aaron. I modified it. I'm not going to use the 4 pounds, as you suggested last week. I'm going to use 3.5. I'm going to cut it down 0.5 pound. It's already the honey portion is already 53% of the fermentables, and so I didn't want to get too carried away with the ABV, knocked it down to just, you know, right around 10%. Hopefully I can stay within that range, and I think that will give me a nice honey aroma and honey character. 30%, actually 45% of the rest of it coming from the two malts, the liquid malt and the Pilsen dry extract. So I in that last email, I think I sent out the recipe there, so you can take a look at it. And I think it was Jeff that suggested that somewhere in the middle on the hops, isn't that what you said? Not to worry about anything in the end, or was that?
That
Ryan?
Was actually that was Ryan. That was Ryan's input on hopping.
Yeah, because I'm using Chinooks, so which is fine. Because I'm looking for the hop. I'm looking for something hoppy. So, you know, although the IBU is only 25.49, hopefully that's going to be enough to you know, to get me there. I might even bump the initial 60 or 30. This is going to be a 30-minute boil. I might even bump the initial up maybe 3/4 of an ounce up front, and then the rest, you know, halfway through at the 15-minute mark, just to get the IBUs up there, because I definitely want the hops. So
yeah, because 25 is, you know, it's hoppy for an ale. It's not necessarily into that. That paleo or imperial range, but you know, it's a noticeable hop presence. If you go a little higher, it's not going to hurt anything. If you go a little lower, you're getting more into like the light lager kind of hop range. You know, it's kind of where you want to go with it.
But this is what I'm thinking, okay? Because I think it's going to take a while for the honey character to kind of work on this project. So I'm thinking, you know, by the time I get it fermented, get it in a carboy, let it sit and age for a couple of weeks, get it into a bottle, and just put them away. I'm thinking, you know, 6, 7, 8 months from now, it ought to be pretty good. So if the IBU starts out relatively high, it may not be that high when we get around to drinking this, even maybe a year from today, right?
I think they are going to mellow out some over time, yes.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I'm looking for. So,
you know, along those lines, I don't know if this is just an anecdote that I ever was able to share with you guys, but going back to that hopped mead deal that I did, you know, several months back, I remember sampling that stuff out of primary, you know, 24 hours after pitching the yeast, 48, 72 hours. And initially that stuff was way over the top in a hop flavor. I mean, it was just insanely strong of a hop flavor, to the point where a couple of them were even unpleasant. And I mean, you guys had the chance to sample them months later after, you know, after they clarified and aged for a bit. And I think it's a comment that Ryan made at one point about how just the strength of the hop character of beers, you know, it diminishes over time. So there's definitely something to that. By the time we got around to drinking those hopped meads, they were not nearly as harsh when it came to the hop profile there. So yeah. Just food for thought for you.
Yeah, interesting, yeah.
Same thing with vanilla. If you overdo vanilla in one of your meads, just let it sit for a while. It'll go away.
Yeah.
I've heard coconut also has that kind of a quality where it diminishes over time.
Coconut, really?
Yeah. I haven't personally experienced that. I don't know that I've ever brewed or made any mead with coconut, but it's just something I heard from a buddy of mine.
Yeah. All right, that out of the way, Chris tossed around an email this afternoon, and we were just going to basically, I guess it's still a free for all, a free for all night, nothing planned, but we've managed to come up with a couple of things to talk about. Chris did toss around an email today. He had some ideas that he wanted to talk about, and Chris, you said something about having no experience with some ingredients that you want to try, things that you've never used before. Did you have a list of those at all, or what are you thinking?
I just want to send it around the table, and I'm fishing for ideas here. So the next few months are going to be extremely busy for me. And then the last part of the year is going to be even busier. So my plan is to do all of this year's mead making in the next few weeks before things hit the fan. And rather than trying to just repeat things that I've done over and over and over, I'd like to come up with some new ideas. And I sort of have an idea of things to stay away from because I've had some spectacular failures, but, and I can pull from those failures to know what not to do, but I want to get people's ideas. I want to get all of your ideas on things, maybe some ingredients that we haven't discussed using, maybe some things that you've thought about using that you've never tried before. And also, it doesn't necessarily have to be exotic ingredients, just maybe just combinations that we haven't thought of. Maybe putting, blackberries with black currants is something that I haven't done before. I'm sure it's been done, but unique combinations that maybe you've had cross your mind.
Any suggestions? Let me. I got to get this out there before I lose it. And it started off this morning with my Earl Grey. I had to buy a new little tea maker deal for my tea, my morning tea. I love my Earl Grey in the morning, and I bought some tea, Jeff, some Earl Grey tea that had magnolia flowers in it, and it made this tea creamy and velvety, and I put honey in my tea, and oh my god, it was great.
There's fresh magnolia flowers on the tree right now all over Mississippi. So
this is going down Jeff's alley because I know Jeff likes to do this floral stuff.
Yeah.
Think magnolia flowers, and now take Chris into your floral teas and things that you've done in the past.
So Mississippi, do you have a dehydrator?
Oh yeah, I do.
If you can score me some magnolia flowers and get those dehydrated for me, so that I can play with those at some point, I would definitely appreciate it because I will take any floral challenge you throw my way, wholeheartedly. I've played with a few different kind of floral ingredients, and those are always nice. I think I've talked about this before that, we're working with honey, which is of course from nectar, which comes from flowers anyway. So it kind of incorporates the whole spectrum of, there is a floral character already in the honey, and you're adding floral character that is, it's not process the way that bees process it to make honey their way. So you're adding different dimensions to it and combining things in an original fashion, in my way of thinking. The flower that I have used the most is hibiscus, and hibiscus is a very powerful flavor. It's very tart. You need a good amount of sweetness or another complementary flavor to balance it. You just do. I know some people have tried balancing it with ginger. The recipe that I shared way back, I think the second or third episode, uses chamomile, which really mellows out that tartness. chamomile, by the way, makes a fantastic meat all by itself as well. It just has a very mellow, kind of vaguely sweet without adding a lot of actual sweetness or sugar flavor to it. So yeah, no, there are a number of different flours, and I've been trying to play with more of them, but you know, sourcing edible flours that are not contaminated with pesticides or things like that is a little bit problematic. So yeah, I'm always looking for things like that.
Well, I can hook you up with magnolia flours because they're all over the place here now.
Excellent. I would really appreciate that.
That I just couldn't get over, you know, in my first sip of that tea, my first thought in my head was Jeff. I thought, man, if Jeff could taste this stuff, he'd be making a meat out of it tomorrow. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, tea is also a great way to base mead. I have done a couple of meads that they are not the best meads I've ever made by any stretch of the imagination, but just replacing the water component of the mead with a fruit tea or an herbal tea, I've gotten some pretty good results with that too.
Yeah. You know, coming from the South, Chris, you know, over on the meat, I know you don't do Facebook, but, and I mentioned this a couple of shows or last show, I can't remember when, but John Talkington over at Mead Makers on Facebook, he has no idea how much. That's the only thing, because he's made this thing so many times, he just knows how much he needs to do. But he made a lemon mead. And the picture on the Facebook page showed this bucket full of sliced lemons, everything, the skin, everything. I'm sure all he did was probably wash the lemons off and sliced them up and dumped them in a bucket. And I'm thinking out of the South, you know, something with lemon and mint would probably be a nice combination. You know, Aaron, you got
any ideas? I was actually thinking about mint because, like something like a mint julep is a very Southern thing, and maybe just a traditional aged on bourbon oak with some mint.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. In fact, you know, I know your thing with the bourbon thing, but I wouldn't even hesitate to dump some bourbon in it. You know, put 8 ounces of bourbon in it. I mean, you're not going to get the alcohol off the bourbon. What you're going to get is that bourbon flavor, which might go good with the lemon and the mint. And call it.
I'd rather send you a bottle and let you put your bourbon in it. You can make a mixer out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and by God, I would too.
I know you would.
okay, so Aaron, you got any ideas for Chris?
Well, so when you were kind of setting the stage for this conversation, I started to think of, you know, two types of ingredients that maybe haven't been as widely explored in mead making. I mean, I guess when I think of meads that are maybe more popular or more ingredients that are more widely used, I mean, I think fruits are very commonly used. You know, different types of honey, different types of yeast, of course, I think are things that people experiment with. And I don't know, maybe I'm off base with this, but to me, herbs and spices are two ingredients that, at least for me personally, I don't necessarily gravitate to or in the past haven't gravitated to. So two things popped into my head, and you guys might kind of roll your eyes at this, and I'm admittedly not sure how well these would turn out, but kind of some off-the-wall types of things. One flavor that I really enjoy, and granted, it's more of a savory type of a flavor that we'll use is basil. And I don't know how that would play in a mead. I can imagine it would be pretty different of a flavor, and maybe something that you would want to pair with something else. What exactly or how to incorporate that ingredient, I don't know. Something that I've wanted to for a while, it's kind of been in the back of my mind too, of incorporating basil somehow into a mead. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that one. There was one other ingredient that I had pop into my mind as well, which is like a curry type of a seasoning or like a curry spice, which I guess is more of like a no. Was that now? Did you do something with that?
I did.
You did.
That
okay.
Already. Yeah. Don't really care to do it again.
So that's a cross off the list and save yourself the time.
Well, it was, it wasn't bad. It wasn't really bad, but it was the kind of thing that you hand someone a small bit of it and say, here, look what I did. And, oh, yeah, that's nice. Okay, move on.
Move on.
Yeah.
You know, the basil, I like the basil idea, Aaron. Why couldn't you do a tomato? Can you do a tomato? I mean, tomato juice? I'm not talking store-bought tomato juice. I'm talking juicing tomatoes to get the clear liquid. Tomato basil.
Well, for me,
juice. Why not?
For me, that would be heartburn in a bottle.
Dude, haven't you ever put? Come on, you're from the South. Tomato like tomato preserves. You don't do preserves. Yeah.
No. I can't do tomato preserves. I love them. I love tomatoes, but they don't like me.
Oh. All right.
But I'm thinking maybe basil and ginger.
Ooh.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I like the sounds of that. I do kind of feel like the basil thing is something that does need to be paired with something else. Here's another thought that I had just as we've been talking here. A few episodes back, we had been talking about like holiday meads, right? And I think one of the ideas that got thrown around was the idea of like a 4th of July watermelon mead. What about watermelon and basil?
Watermelon would be very nice with basil, I would think. And actually, now that I think about it, JD mentioned John Talkington. And if memory serves, John Talkington has a, I forget how well it did at Mazer Cup, but it did extremely well. He has a mead that was made with basil, lime basil, and limes that he calls basilisk. That apparently it was quite a striking combination of flavors there. Off the top of my head, I had another idea and it completely escaped my mind.
Well, this sounds.
How about if I take a page from Sergio's book? What if I did a cucumber basil?
There you go.
Sure.
There you go. Right there.
Yeah,
That's right there. That's the one.
Because he had that one pepino with the cucumber, and I think it was lemon and orange zest or something.
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah, because basil is one of those herbs that's a savory herb, but if you get some good basil, it's got this sweetness to it.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't put them in the fermenter. I'd put the basil in secondary.
JD, you had that pepino, the cucumber from Sergio. Was that a sweet or a semi-sweet or do you
No,
remember?
It was there was no sweetness to it at all, as I recall. It was a very cucumber. There was no mistaking it was cucumber. But I thought, didn't that one have the jalapeno in it?
No, it was just.
I think the wrong one. But I know the cucumber. The cucumber one was very refreshing. My wife liked the cucumber one very much.
And it was dry.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So I actually remembered my thought too for that other option. You guys are familiar with the concept of a mojito, right? There's cane sugar, there's rum, there's some mint in it.
Yeah.
I know a couple people that are actually, they're allergic to mint. And so there's a variation of that you make with basil instead of mint. My thought was something along the lines of, and this is really out there as far as flavors go, but I think that's kind of the goal here anyway. Using some raw sugar like Turbino or, there are so many different varieties of it out there to get a really raw sugar flavor to it, and maybe some rum extract to make a kind of a basil mojito, kind of very summery, light, refreshing kind of a meat.
Oh man, that sounds good too. Mm-hmm. Oh man,
or maybe just some maple syrup.
If you can keep the maple flavor in it,
you would. I would think you would want to use one of the lighter maple syrups that has a. It's not as the flavor isn't quite as dark, I guess. Yeah, keep it kind of light so that it balances well with the basil and the other flavors. I just feel like basil is a kind of a light flavor that could easily be overpowered if you overdid any one ingredient too much. But it also, from cooking with it, I feel like it does a great job of kind of bringing out and pairing nicely with other light flavors.
Yeah, and a lot goes a little goes a long way too.
It does
with cooking. So, but man, yeah, cucumber basil. And if you carbonate it, I mean, dude, that's like a summertime drink right there. That's one of those things you stick the little umbrella in and go sit out on the patio and drink, man, on a hot day.
So I'm looking at three here. I'm looking at the cucumber basil. I'm looking at the basil ginger, and then the basil mojito. I guess it would be
mojito. Yeah,
mojito.
Mojito. And you can get the if you don't want to use rum, or if you don't want to use your own rum, make your own rum wood chips, you can get the rum flavored wood from labelpeelers.com if you can't find it anywhere else.
Okay.
You can also just get rum extract from the supermarket and
rum extract.
No, it's all the flavor with none of the alcohol.
Put real rum in it.
Of course, put real rum in it.
Put some real rum in it. Get some good rum. Put some real rum in it.
Okay, I'll go the rum route.
Cool.
I'll be the rum runner.
There you go.
Just for you, JD. Yes,
there you go.
Okay. So now let's toss around some other ideas here. I was thinking about doing some off the wall combinations of things that are fairly common in mead making now. So let's take the idea of the bochet, some caramelized honey, and then have you ever thought about using that to make your melomels? Rather than just dumping honey in, how do you think that would play? Because now I know that some of you, Jeff, I know for sure, has had more experience with the bochets than I have.
Right. How do you picture that playing? I happen to think if you got the right fruit flavors, that could be really nice. For example, it might be a mixture of tart and sweet cherries. But I think a cherry melomel with some bochet backing
to it could be really interesting. It could get a little depth of that flavor to it. I would think the same for a blackberry too, although there's there's a little bit more tartness to the blackberry than to the cherry. The fact that you will have some residual sugar that just comes from the Bochet converting it into non-fermentable sugar, that'll just help you in the long run there. Off the top of my head, those are the two that really strike me as being a good idea to pair with the Bochet. And the blackberry, I'm just a big fan of blackberry too, in case it hasn't been obvious on the show. That really does seem like a good option, because it's the sweetness is a little less pronounced, and the tartness I think would kind of balance out a little bit easier with the honey. I would think, just this is instinct on my part, and I'm backing this up with very little data, but that's just kind of my presupposition here.
Mm-hmm. One of the drinks that my wife and I enjoy during the summertime are pineapple margaritas. And I'll have to send out my recipe for my margarita list for margaritas out to you guys. There's a pineapple margarita that I make. It starts out with a decent reposado tequila, and you get a whole pineapple. And you skin it off and slice it, about half-inch thick slices, and you grill them. You grill them until they're almost black on each side. Some good deep caramelization is what you're looking for. And after you let them cool, the yumminess that drips off, the caramelized sugars that drip off, you put all of that and the cut-up pineapple in a container and dump in a bottle, a 750-milliliter bottle of a good Reposado tequila. And you let it sit for about a month. So I'm thinking roasted pineapples with your caramelized honey to give that roastiness, that caramelization, and the pineapple flavor. So roasted pineapple meat.
Okay.
And you say that.
Makes the list.
You say that. I would even throw in maybe some of that, and we're getting ahead of ourselves here, some of that meadow foam honey that has kind of that caramely, toasty marshmallow flavor. That could be a damn fine combination by itself.
Yeah. If you take your caramel, you don't want to caramelize your honey too far. You just want to get in, just take it just past that marshmallow stage, and then mix it with some of that meadow foam. Oh, dude, I think you're on something there.
No.
Yeah.
I
can see just doing a traditional with that, honestly.
Yeah.
Another one that I did last year for the fall, it was a very small batch, but it was just for fun to see how it turned out. Caramel apple mead. Make a sizer with Bochet, with caramelized honey. So it's a Bochet sizer. And yeah, it came out sweet. It came out appley. And it, overall, it wasn't terribly interesting. I didn't use the most exquisite honey for that particular application. But yeah, the roastiness of it kind of paired very nicely with the apple and took a little bit of the bite out of the tartness, too, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. I can hear
that. Sounds very similar. That sounds very similar to what happened with the graph, with that caramel 120 grain. It lended a certain caramel note to it.
Yeah. Aaron, I hear the pen scratching on the desk. Are you taking notes?
you better believe it.
Yeah, I know, because it's going to be a while before you get your mead house set up. But what are you thinking here?
So let me kind of talk you through my thought process here. And I know, I think the question that was posed was a Bochet Melomel hybrid. And
no, any weird combination of techniques or, common fruits that we all use, but we just never thought of doing them together.
Gotcha. Well, so here's my thought process. You know, I started thinking of caramelizing honey and kind of the transition or the change in flavor that you get. And you know, as you start to caramelize it, you start to get some marshmallow, toasted marshmallow types of flavors. As you continue to go, you know, maybe as it starts to approach that burning phase, you get some more like dark chocolate types of flavors. And I started thinking, well, what types of fruits would pair with that? And the first thing that really popped in my head was like a banana split type of a thing where, you know, you got your banana ice cream, you're topping it with maybe some chocolate and maybe some nuts as well. So that's kind of where my head went, was like a banana split bocher where you're adding bananas, enough bananas to the point where you're really extracting that banana flavor. And then maybe also incorporating, I know this is a topic that we've also touched on, incorporating some nuts, either maybe some peanuts or some cashews, and, you know, pairing those flavors with a pretty deeply caramelized honey might be something kind of interesting.
You know, if that you don't get good. Banana split, you could easily go with the caramelized honey and the banana. And do a banana Foster as well.
Ooh, yeah.
Either of those, I think, would be a home run, assuming you pull this off.
Well, you know I did that banana bread mead, and that turned out good.
Yeah.
I know you've talked about your usage of bananas before, so but walk us through that banana bread one.
Well, I took the bananas, I peeled the bananas, and I put them in a crock pot with water and let them cook for about 6 hours. And then I strained off the liquid, and I used the liquid in the mead and got a real good banana flavor from it.
Well, heck, what if you just caramelized the bananas with the honey all at the same time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's worth
it. You would have to do it in several batches because it took a lot of bananas to fit in the crock pot. So,
but wouldn't the bananas just turn to mush because that your honey's going to get pretty darn hot?
Yeah, so but I strained those out.
Okay.
Well, so you strained out the solid.
I did when I only did the water extraction. Now, if I was doing it, you know, I'd probably do the honey separately because that would be a big mess.
Yeah.
That sounds good. Go ahead, Jeff.
Wow. I was just going to say, you know, if you put the bananas in something like a paint strainer bag or you did this with a, like Scott Monroe suggested, in one of those little the crock pot liners, cut the corner off to squeeze it in, and you pushed it through some kind of a sieve or a mesh to get all the solids out of it. Doing the banana and the honey together could work. At some point, you're going to slow down your caramelization process on your honey just because the more heat you apply to the banana, the more the liquid in the banana you're going to extract, and that's going to get kind of convoluted with the liquid in the honey. And slow down the caramelization process of that honey too. So, you know, we're in really speculative territory here, but it could take a while to get that just right.
Yeah, that's why I think it'd be better off to do it separately to begin with. But you know that banana bread meat is just basically a banana bread recipe made into a mead.
I cruise around the Homebrew Talk forum over there, the beer forum, and I've read some crazy stuff over there. I mean, guys dumping entire chocolate cakes. I don't mean the cake mix and all the components. I mean, dumping, baking a chocolate cake, frosted the whole nine yards, dumping it in the boil, and coming out with a fairly decent beer. So anything's possible. Dude, I think you got some pretty, in fact, why don't you just quit doctoring and just start making mead?
I think I should.
Man, you got some good ideas flowing here.
Life would be a lot more enjoyable. There's no doubt about it.
But you were talking methaglins here in your email. Something about nutmeg. You're talking just using nothing but nutmeg?
Yeah, I was tossing around the idea of doing a dry nutmeg, methaglin. And the nutmeg that I have used has always been used as a slight accent to something that I had already made, maybe in an apple pie mead or something like that. And so I wanted to get your guys' input on what do you think a decent amount of nutmeg would be to use if I wanted to get, you know, a good pronounced nutmeg flavor.
That's another dry traditional. That, yeah, you know, like basil, that's another one, a little bit goes long way type thing.
Absolutely.
I don't know where you'd even start there. You're talking whole nutmeg, right?
Yeah, just a whole cracked nutmeg.
Busting it up, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do you roughly, guys think per gallon?
From what I've done, and granted what I've done has been more of a pie spice mead that used nutmeg and a couple other things in it, I would say a quarter to a half of a teaspoon per gallon is a good starting point. And I usually do mine in, I'll take whole nutmegs, and I have a microplane that I grind it into a powder with. I stick the powder in a coffee filter and tie that off with either some nylon string or some dental floss on wax that's been soaked in star sand, and then use that essentially to pull it when I think it's got enough of that flavor in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would start there and just kind of, again, the rule of thumb with a lot of spices is just kind of dial it in. The other thing you could think about if you're looking for a nutmeg flavor, it's harder to come by in this country, but there's a spice called mace. As I'm given to understand it, nutmeg comes from the nut of this fruit, whereas mace is kind of the fruity part, although fruit is a bad way to say it. It's more of a fibrous outside cover, but it would be the analog of the fruit on an actual fruit. Mace is a little bit more, it's less pronounced in that flavor, but it's a little bit like rounder and earthier as well. So you might try trying to track some of that down and using a little bit of that, or use that in combination with nutmeg to get a little bit more depth of flavor too.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So I'm probably looking at maybe two whole nutmegs would probably do a 5 gallon batch more than enough.
I would say so. I would hold on to a third nutmeg on the wing and just, and keep that in case you decide you need more of that nutmeg flavor. But I would say two would be enough for a start.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's easy to add more. It's not easy to take away. So
exactly.
And as with most all methaglins, this is going to go in secondary, so it's easier to control.
Right.
Okay. So next topic, I guess we could call this the ingredient of the week, and it's black currants. And I just want to get your take on them. I know JD hates black currants, but
bad fruit
bomb. Yeah. So this will be Aaron and Jeff on this probably,
yeah.
But because JD's suggestion is going to be don't use it.
Add juju.
Yeah, you're that's your bourbon for me.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, I've got like I'm out the gills with black currants, and I need to use them. So I've already got some set aside for a big batch of the heart murmur that I'm going to do. But I'm still overrun with black currants. So head off with, you know, take it where you want to go with it. What would you do?
So the black currants make me think of two different things, and my wife will have to forgive me for this, but the first time that I brought some black currant into the house to try as a meat ingredient, I got some of the concentrated juice. Is it Knudsen's or I can't remember. It's the kind of juice you get at the health food store, the Whole Foods store, and it is tart as all get out.
Juju, wasn't it?
My wife has never had black currant juice, and I apparently the juice that I've had prior to that was marketed as black currant juice in Central and Eastern Europe is actually a combination of juices, and I'll get to that. I found it very pleasant, but this stuff is just the juice of black currants, and oh my God, is it tart? And she, bless her, she took a sip of this with, you know, nothing sweetening it, nothing, no other flavors attached to it, and was expecting something that tasted like juice, i.e. sweet, and was shocked and surprised and kind of disgusted. Suffice it to say, my wife has a terrible opinion of black currants now. When I was living in Prague, I had a juice that I bought kind of regularly that was marketed as a black currant juice, but it was, I gather that it was cut with mostly apple juice and maybe some other fruit juices like pear or maybe a little bit of cherry juice, but it was sweet and tart together, which made it, you know, more interesting to me and a little bit more palatable than a lot of the very sweet fruit juices out there. So I think if I were going to approach a black currant juice, it might be fun to do a black currant sizer. I like the idea of adding that to sweeter fruits in general as well.
Okay. Well, I've done every other kind of sizer, so
right.
I'm not a black currant.
Aaron?
Yeah, so for me, you know, I think, let me preface this by saying black currant is probably the one fruit that I have on my to-do list that I find the most fascinating. I have had the opportunity to have a few meads over the years that incorporate black currants, either as the primary single only fruit used or in other cases as a blend with other fruits. And I really, really like the results that you get with black currants. Just that, as Jeff was kind of describing, the balance that you get of tart and sour from that black currant flavor, balanced with residual sweetness from honey, fermented honey, I really find that to be a very tasty beverage. So, you know, I think for me, probably approaching it more from a, for lack of a better word, traditional melomel standpoint is probably what's high on my to brew list. Having said that, I think something that would be maybe a little bit of an interesting twist here is something that I know, not to recycle content from a previous show, but something that we've discussed in the past is using kind of like a fortified mead or fortified melomel, where you take your base blackcurrant melomel and add in like some port to it. To me, I think at least starting with a small batch, maybe with a 1 gallon experimental size, that might be something that could blend very well.
Yeah, and the only experience that I've had doing a straight blackcurrant melomel was the one that I added the jalapenos or the habaneros too, which turned into what I call the heat of the night, because it was black and it was hot. And that was pretty interesting because the sweet, I made it severely sweet because of the tartness, but the sweet play, it was cloyingly sweet before the peppers. But once the heat of the peppers came in there, it was just perfect. So I'm just wondering if I should go that route, or I don't know how most people are going to react to that much pepper heat in a beverage.
You know, that is definitely a fascinating idea. And like JD said earlier, my pen has been writing ferociously throughout the course of this episode. I have so much on my to-brew list here. I'll tell you, one of the black currant meads that really sticks out to me, I think it's, I'm just doing some quick Googling here. I think it's the White Winter Winery does, they call it their black mead, and it is just a traditional melomel, I guess, with just black currants and honey. And boy, is that good. It's a little bit on the drier side, and I could see, like you're saying, adding some hot peppers to that might really take it up to another level.
Yeah. Well, that's another topic that I had mentioned in the email, is that I wanted to venture into some drier meads. That's something that I don't have much experience with, and I know that you and Jeff both do that quite often, especially with your hydromels. I don't want to do a hydromel, however. I want to stick with my more wine-like style mead, but start, maybe I'm not ready to go all the way dry, but maybe off dry or the low end of the semi-sweet range. So right. So start, throw me some ideas there. What do you got in mind that I might could try there?
Well, as far as off dry goes, if you're using 71B or D47, which are kind of like the workhorse staples for what we do, you want your target starting gravity to be about 1110. You can go as high as 1120, depending on what else you're putting in there. But I find I get a lot of good off-dry flavor at 1110. And if, for whatever reason, it turns out a little bit drier than your preference goes, you can always stabilize and add a little bit extra honey then. That's kind of the starting point I get for a lot of the more wine strength, drier, method blends that I've been doing. And you know, if you're going to go off dry, you really need to carefully balance the flavors of what you're working with. For example, the apple pie sizer that I made, it has a lot of tartness to it because I used basswood honey and I used some fresh apple cider that literally came right off the press. But that kind of balanced out with a lot of earthy spiciness that chilled that out a little bit. It is probably too tart for some palates, but for my palate, it came out very nicely. So there's a little bit of grain of salt there, but that would be my take on it for a start.
Yeah, well, I knew that if I went the route of a melomel, I know that I can't do, I probably can't pull off this drier mead and still follow my normal routine of adding, you know, 6-7 pounds of fruit per gallon. That's not going to work too well, especially with something real tart. So
right.
You're thinking of keeping it still or carbonating maybe at all to change the complexity a little bit, or what are you thinking along that?
No, I want to get a good dry still mead because it's one of the hardest things to make in mead making. Anything dry with honey is hard to pull off and do it well. So it makes it a little bit easier when you're going the hydromel route and you're carbonating it, because it you don't have as many opportunities for flaws, and you have more opportunity to cover up flaws. But if you're just making a wine strength, dry traditional, that's a difficult thing to pull off. And so that's what I want to try to do, is it doesn't have to be traditional necessarily, but, it could be a Melomel, it could be a Metheglin, but I've never pulled off a really good dry mead, and I want to do that.
Well, and I think the thing to think about here is that I've talked before, there's kind of a triangle of different characteristics. You've got your sweetness, you've got your tartness or your acidity, and then you've got the astringency or the tannic elements. And to be in balance, you know, if you've got one of those going one way very strongly, you know, the rest of them kind of need to compensate. If you're taking the sweetness down to where this is a dry or off-dry mead, you really need to dial back a lot of the acidity and a lot of the tannin structure. And I think from the way I'm picturing it in my mind, the way I'm imagining it, and what little I have done with Melomels at the off-dry stage, the right way to go with that is more like a suggestion of that fruit than like that full-on fruit flavor. The exception to that, I would say, is that I actually made a mulberry mead that my wife and I absolutely love. We are convinced it is the best thing that I have ever made, actually. And it is the mulberries are very slightly tart, but they do have a presence of tannin in them that is appreciable there. Although this is a very dry mead too, it's almost like the if you guys sip church wine, you know, you have that kind of a tannic bite on the very start, like right on the lips and the tip of your tongue. And it kind of, when it washes over, you get a little bit of a burn from, it's a combination of, you know, the acid in the wine and maybe a little bit of oxidation in it too. The tartness up front on the lips is there, but then it's just incredibly smooth over the mid palate and down your throat. Whereas you're expecting something like really harsh, and it's almost even more refreshing that way, to my way of thinking, because you're set up from, you know, the years of going to church and having that communion wine to expect something worse, and it's just really smooth and really pleasant instead.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So,
JD,
I know I'm contradicting myself there, but
yeah. What, are we not talking black currants anymore?
No, we're talking ideas for the dry stuff.
I like, you know, my wine. I'm not a wine connoisseur, but I do appreciate some you know, pretty good wine. And I drink both reds and white, more reds, and you know why that is. But I do on occasion drink nice Chardonnays. I love Pinot Grigios. So for me, it would be something along that line. You know, Pinot Grigio's got just a very hint of a little bit of sweetness to it. It's on the drier side. It's really good stuff. I love a good Pinot Grigio. The Chardonnays, some of them can be kind of tart. And on the dry side. But the thing that I would be concerned about would be the mouthfeel part. How do you suppose you would incorporate some kind of mouthfeel? And I'll tell you the reason why I'm asking, because I got to go back to the very first one that I made that's still in the bottle in the bedroom that's going on, what, almost more than 3 years old now. It's still, I mean, it tastes good, but it's watery. No mouthfeel to it. Mm-hmm. How would you go about incorporating mouthfeel into it? That would be a big concern of mine.
Well, I would think two things come to my mind immediately. number one is going to be finding the right fruit. If I use a fruit, whether it's just a common fruit that we have or whether it's wine grapes or whatever, I know that Ryan had mentioned one time about liking a dry Riesling, and I had promised him that I might make like a dry Riesling Piemont for him or something. So fruit selection is going to contribute the right tannin structure, which is going to be the mouthfeel. And the other portion of that would be yeast selection. I'm pretty certain that this is not going to be my standard 71B mead. I'm going to have to find some. I'm going to have to find just the right yeast to that can contribute the right polysaccharides and things to help with mouthfeel. D47 is pretty good about that, but it works a lot better in lighter colored things than it does if I was making like a Cabernet Piemont or something. So I don't know. I'm thinking maybe D254 or something.
Yeah. And what about you're in muscadine territory, right?
Yeah.
What about using muscadine juice or muscadine grapes? I know those, you know, typically those they make pretty sweet wines out of that, but I have had some I wouldn't call them probably the other side of semi-sweet. What is that, off dry? Maybe not even that. Muscadine wine that we picked up in North Carolina, and which was quite good. I enjoyed it. Not the sweet stuff is not my wine of choice. In fact, I can only drink very little of it. But muscadine, common in your area, if you can get your hands on some muscadine grapes, why not use that?
Yeah, they you have to be careful with muscadines, and I think one of the reasons that people tend to make it sweet is because muscadines are lower in the tannin and higher in the acidity range. In fact, muscadines often are in the acidity range of a very high acidic white wine. So, you know, you would have that to contend with.
Yeah.
So getting muscadines at the right time of year, there's only about a three-day period when they're at their peak. And as of late, in the last few years, it's been a competition with the deer population. The deer population in this area has just exploded. And so you've got to get to them before the deer do.
I would even venture off and go look at some concentrate. Ryan was back, I think. In fact, that may have been the one that the carboy explosion that he had, if I'm not mistaken. He was working on a piment. I believe that's called a pine, where you take grape juice and honey. Why don't you look at some grape juice concentrates in the white wine category? I mean, you can get Pinot Grigio. Well, I think you can get like Pinot Grigio, Chardonnays. You know, even if you, I know Ryan. I mean, Ryan hears this, he'll have a conniption fit. But you know, you can look at a white wine kit wine and perhaps use the juice out of that. And you know, if you go that route, I mean, my gosh, you got Pinot Grigios, you got Chardonnays, Rieslings, a number of different kinds of grapes, grape juices that you can use if you went that direction. I don't know, as far as the concentrates, I don't know what's available out there. But
well, Riesling and Gewürztraminer are my two favorite white wines. And I think they may be my favorite because you guys know that they typically come a little bit sweeter than most wines.
Sweet.
And I'm not real big on dry things, so that may be why I gravitate toward those two. But Ryan said that he and his wife both enjoyed a dry Riesling. So if I remember correctly, I think I promised him that I might make him a dry Riesling pie as an experiment. So that's where I need to go with that.
Yeah, I would try that. I would go the Riesling route. And, you know, because that's one out of the sweet wines. I would prefer the drier side in a Riesling as well. I'm not a sweet wine drinker. I mean, I like a nice Riesling, but can only stand to drink, you know, a couple of sips out of the glass, and that's enough for me. But a dry one might not be so bad.
Yeah. Okay. That may be how I go with that.
Yeah. Sounds like a plan.
Well, you guys will be getting an email once I get things narrowed down. I'm going to lay out sort of the blueprint, and I'm going to send it around and let you guys amend it and add suggestions, and we'll get these batches rolling because I've got to get this stuff done before too much longer. I'm not going to be able to get them done this year.
Yeah, I hear you. And my box.
Well, your box is coming before the meads. So I've actually got some time next week that's going to be used that I know for a fact I'm off. And that's going to get finished up. And then bottles are going out to all you guys. I don't have a lot to send out right now, actually, but I'll get out a few that I have. And then I got to get these batches knocked out.
Perfect.
Along the topic of odd flavor combinations and different flavor combinations, there's one I've been doodling for the last couple of weeks that kind of got touched on tangentially. What do you guys think about odd combinations or good combinations for ginger?
Ginger.
Well, I like the ginger basil idea, honestly. I think that's probably going to be my choice there. I'm pretty sure I'm going to do the ginger basil, and I'm going to do the cucumber basil for sure.
The cucumber basil sounds good.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. But as far as the ginger, you know, ginger just goes with it goes with sweet, it goes with savory, it goes with spicy.
Mm-hmm.
You could do like a habanero mead with ginger. You could do, I don't know.
Yeah, I was honestly thinking about a little bit more like that bitter orange flavor that I got from the orange cream ale that JD had sent. That seems like it would be a nice kind of complement to that, especially with a bite from ginger.
I agree.
Yeah, how about a Blue Moon clone with ginger added?
You know, I made a wit beer years and years ago that I thought was really nice, except I did a little bit, you know, over the top with coriander and. Maybe dialing some coriander back and putting some ginger into that would be a good idea. That could actually be a really good summertime drink.
Yeah, let me think here just a second. Oh, gosh. My ginger metheglin is one of my favorites that I've ever made. And it's real simple. It's 12 ounces of grated ginger per gallon,
mm-hmm.
And a final gravity of 10-20 with orange blossom honey. Put the ginger right in primary, 71B. It's one of my favorites that I've made. So I'm trying to sort of take that and extrapolate from it. What could you do to that?
Yeah, because the you know,
maybe a Moscow mule. How about making a Moscow mule?
Yeah,
there you go.
I had also thought about, you know, the a lime, kind of the lime and ginger, and if on our honeymoon we had a kind of a layover in Dublin, so we went to the Jameson Distillery amongst other you know, drinking establishments there, and they served us Jameson with the lime juice and the ginger in a kind of a cocktail glass, not unlike that. And that was a really great combination. I don't know about getting the whiskey flavor in there, but the lime and the ginger together had also struck me as maybe a possibility there.
Yeah, do a Moscow Mule mead and age it on some bourbon oak.
Yeah.
All right.
That sounds good.
Cool ideas.
Starting
Missouri Mule.
Yeah, Missouri Mule. Mississippi Mule.
No, this is Jeff's. This is not mine.
Okay. Missouri Mule, then. Geez, guys, I feel like this show could go on and on and on and on and on and on and on. But we need to wrap this one up. So we're gonna stop it right here. And Ryan should be back next week. And when he comes back, we got a lot of work ahead of us. We've got 9 different honeys that we need to taste along with Ryan and give our 2 cents worth. Plus, we got a couple of meads from Ryan that we're going to taste as well. So plenty coming in the next few shows. Look for us again next week. This is episode 49. 50 of them in the bag next show. So that's kind of exciting. So with that, why don't we come back next week? We'll do it all over again.